Power Hour, March 29th at 7 a.m. People can also contribute early by calling 217-244-9455 or going online at willpledge.org. You can take off the leg warmers now.
Can I still keep my Focus 580 sweatbands?
The Power Hour, 7 a.m., March 29th.
Support for programs comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings every Saturday from 2 to 6, and beer and spirit tastings on Sundays from 3 to 5. Information at thecorkscrew.com.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour 2 of the show. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of Focus, we will go to the archives for a program first broadcast in February of 2006, conversation with Mia Bloom about her book Dying to Kill. So do keep in mind as you listen that in this hour we will not be taking calls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about suicide terrorism. What would motivate someone, a young man or a young woman, to become a suicide bomber, to strap explosives to their body, to go into a crowded public place, to blow themselves up, thus killing themselves and as many people as they could who were around them? There are a number of explanations that have been offered by scholars. Some say, for example, that suicide bombers have been brainwashed, that they may be motivated by extreme poverty or extreme despair. Our guest this hour, Focus 580, however, says that these only offer partial explanations. We will be talking with Mia Bloom. She is assistant professor of political science at the University of Cincinnati, who has done quite a bit of study in this area. She's the author of a book that was published last May of 2005, by the Columbia University Press, entitled Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror. So it's a book that certainly would be available in the bookstore or the library if you're interested in reading it. And it takes a look at why it is that individuals might become suicide bombers and why it is that organizations, that groups, would adopt suicide terror as a strategy, and also looks at why it is that some groups eventually do abandon this tactic. Professor Bloom, hello.
Hi, good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Oh, I'm fine.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And good, you know, is it good morning to your listeners or good afternoon?
It is morning. It is morning still here for us. There are a number of very basic points, I guess, we might make at the beginning, and then I want to, in some detail, talk about these basic questions of individuals and their choices and groups and their choices and popular support or lack of it for this this technique. But I guess one thing that I do want to start out with is this notion that you go into right just in the very beginning of the book, that perhaps a lot of the commonplace explanations that have been given, particularly explanations for why it is an individual should do this, it's not that they're wrong. It's that it's not enough. It perhaps doesn't go enough to explaining why someone would do this.
I think some of these somewhat simplistic or monocausal explanations that say it's, you know, one particular thing, an exogenous factor like occupation or opposition to American policies, I think it doesn't really get at what is motivating individuals at the very basic level that make them decide that this is a strategy that they want to employ. Because so many of these organizations that have suicide bombers attached to them, they don't actually go out and recruit in the traditional sense. They basically sit around and wait for people to show up and volunteer. And so because there are so many people at the very grassroots level volunteering, we need to understand what are the dynamics, sort of in a very micro way, what are the dynamics that are motivating them, what makes them think that this is a good idea, whether it's religious justifications. Over 80% of the suicide bombers who have been interviewed, so presumably these are the failed ones. The successful ones are very difficult to interview. So among the failed bombers, 80% think that Islam is justifying this and that they are doing God's will. But at the same time, what are some of the other factors that they personally experience, whether it's some sort of humiliation as a result of the occupation or some sort of personal loss, having lost a family member or, in many of the cases in Chechnya with the women, a husband, And so this is their way of expressing their grief and their outrage, or possibly because existing institutions through which they could express it legitimately don't exist. Yeah. And so there's a lot of different things going on.
At one point, I'm sure we wanted to talk about this distinction between religious and nationalist motivations. Up front, as you do in your book, I think particularly because now there is so much attention focused on suicide bombers who also happen to be Muslim. You say in the book, and I'm sure that you would want to make the point, that there is nothing about Islam that predisposes people to violence. And as you point out in the book, just about all religious groups have at some point used this tactic, and there are also secular groups who have used it as well.
And more importantly, not only is there nothing dysfunctional about Islam, but someone who has a truly deep understanding of the Islamic faith knows that suicide bombing, and in particular what we're observing in Iraq, goes against three major injunctions in Islam. One injunction against suicide, one injunction against killing civilians, women and children, and the infirm, and then finally another injunction against killing other Muslims. And yet we're finding organizations that are bending the theology or manipulating it, or finding maybe some sheikhs in Saudi Arabia or in Egypt to provide ex post facto justifications. But in effect, anyone who truly understands Islam knows that suicide bombing runs contrary to Islam. And in fact, you know, there are statements that the Prophet, you know, peace be upon him, had always preferred to negotiate peacefully.
Mm-hmm. To talk, perhaps we could talk a little bit here about organizations and how and why they make the choice to do this as a tactic. And I think that, again, here, perhaps the most commonplace sort of analysis is that groups decide on terrorism because they have no other good options, because their opponent is much more powerful, bigger than they are, and that's really the only choice that they have. And in fact, I think there are probably some who would even go as far as to say that when a group takes on terrorism as a topic, it is a sign that, in fact, they've actually lost. Perhaps the answer to the question is, well, yes, that may in some sense be true, but that's not a very, very complete explanation of why it is a group would do this or what they think they get out of it.
And part of the problem is also that, you know, there's a definitional issue, which, you know, not to belabor the point, but I know it's a college town, but because there is no one standard definition of what is terrorism, no one accepted definition globally or even within the United States between different agencies, the State Department has a different definition than the military, etc., it becomes very difficult to disaggregate at what point this is a regular civil war or an insurgent movement or an opposition movement that uses violence versus terrorism. And so because of the lack of definitional clarity, we do have that age-old adage where one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. For many British in 1776, I'm sure they looked across the pond and at George Washington and thought, oh, well, this is a terrorist. And so that's part of the problem. So I don't know if it's that, you know, once you use violence, you've already lost. I think that you're absolutely right that it does play into this idea of asymmetric warfare, the fact that, you know, even when you interview the leaders of the organizations about why they use terrorism, or specifically suicide terrorism, they say, you know, if we had tanks and planes and nuclear weapons, we wouldn't need to. But, you know, they're working from the law of comparative advantage. They have lots of people willing to make these sacrifices, and so they're literally throwing bodies at the problem.
Yeah.
And so, again, that is part of the explanation. I think, you know, you can make just as much argument, let's say, with regard to what's going on in Iraq, that democracy provides a forum for organizations and groups to express their grievances through legitimate institutions and mechanisms. But at the same time, democracy also unleashes the possibility of more of these hateful groups, racist groups, or groups with very much a, sort of a single agenda. So there's no way to know. And I would say that part of the story that we're not discussing is what makes the terrorist group sometimes turn violent, maybe the responses of the state that they're up against. There's one instance with the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam that I describe in the book where the LTTE did not start out as a violent organization. The Tamil Liberation Front was a political party that was actually participating in the parliament, and bit by bit, their rights in the parliament were limited and then eventually done away with. Discrimination increased against this group, and so violence was not the first choice. Violence only was only entered into the fray maybe 20 years down the line. And so I think it's also very important to remember what the states do, whether it's the global war on terror or the struggle against religious extremism. We have to understand that we sometimes sow the seeds of our future problems by what we're doing now.
I think it's interesting when you look at all the many and the varied reasons that a group might choose to do this, that it draws attention to their cause. It establishes, at least in the minds of the group and others, it establishes, may establish their political legitimacy. It aids in recruiting. And it the cost of the group is little because you're sacrificing one individual. And that it seems that the goal of killing your enemy, put that in quotes, is actually rather far down the list.
Absolutely. And this varies from conflict to conflict to the degree in which inflicting harm on the other side is, you know, the higher priority versus showing dedication to the cause or for the nation, for love of God and country kind of thing. But I would say that the revenge aspect is still very, very high up. And there's a number of surveys that are being done, psychological surveys, in the territories and in other places, let's say in Europe, where they're measuring the fact that people gain a great deal of satisfaction from exercising violence against people they feel against whom they're aggrieved, people that have done them wrong. And so there's different kind of psychological measures. But, I mean, it's absolutely the case that it's very difficult to disaggregate when you're talking to the individual whether, you know, was it a secular nationalist, you know, for country, or was it a religious inspiration because you want to go to heaven and intercede for 70 of your family members. And the problem with seeing it as an either-or is that in the minds of the individuals, all of these things are mixed.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on what it is that they're expressing at that moment, they'll say, you know, it's for our holy places and for God and for the nation. And so when you have the religious authorities coming out with, say, a fatwa, an Islamic ruling that says, oppose the occupation, it's then very difficult to, you know, using political science terminology, code it as one or the other. I tend to view these issues more along a spectrum, that we do have certain organizations that are sort of ideal, typically very secular and have no religious aspect to them, the LTT, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam being one of them. And then we have certain groups that are just completely religious and basically have no territorial base. Al-Qaeda, Asulba, the main core of Al-Qaeda, would be on that side of the spectrum. But the majority of these groups and organizations that use suicide bombing fall somewhere in between. And many of them have very local and very sort of micro-level issues against the government and not these big ideas of world revolution or global jihad.
Just maybe I'll quickly introduce again the guest for this part of Focus. We're talking with Mia Bloom. She is assistant professor of political science at the University of Cincinnati, and we're talking about some of what you will find in her book, Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror. It's published by the Columbia University Press. It came out last May of 2005. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Going to the question of individuals and their motivation, I think, as we discussed a little bit at the beginning, that often it is said that here we have people who, the individuals are people who have been somehow manipulated, that they're people who may be emotionally dysfunctional, that they may be people who are deeply in despair about their personal situation or the situation of their people. They may indeed feel that there is some kind of religious reward for doing this. But I guess I'm interested particularly in as you rank all of these things, to what extent revenge is a motivation, but also the feeling by that individual that they, by this act, are striking out against injustice.
I mean, it's absolutely the case that, you know, since most of the recruitment is not a traditional form of recruitment, but it's coming from these grassroots organizations, people know exactly where the storefronts are in order to go and volunteer. There were a few instances of interviews that I listed in the book where someone went to one storefront and they were told, well, you know, we're out of bombs today, but if you go down the street around the corner, go to the Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigades, we think they have some bombs. And so, you know, again, it's very much that these terrorist organizations are embedded within their civil society. People know where they are and who they are, and they know the persona. And so it's very important that they keep pace with, I guess, the public opinion or the support networks, because they can't survive without the civilian population that they purport to represent. And so that's why in the book I mention that if they do things, if they go too far, or if they begin engaging in violence that the larger population rejects, they lose popularity. Whereas if they engage in violence and the population is very supportive of it, they gain popularity, and I think Hamas's recent electoral victory in part can be explained by the degrees of violence. By and large, the majority of the bombers will provide some sort of rationalization. You know, they talk about, I knew someone who died, or I saw the martyrdom of a child on TV and it so moved me. I felt the need to do something. What is most surprising about these interviews is that for whatever reason, many of the Palestinians, as an example, and I'm going to use that just because that's where a lot of the interviews came from, would say things like, well, you know, we feel that we may be killed at any moment, and the bombs are falling everywhere, and the bombs don't distinguish between civilians and military targets. And because we think that we may be killed at any moment, by becoming the bomber, we decide the time and place. And so for a very strange, you know, reasoning, they feel that this is empowering them. And so that they are able to then make the, you know, I decide when, I decide where. And this is, again, very problematic. Many of the people are suffering from some sort of post-traumatic stress disorder. Certainly, these are very long conflicts. But I would say that, you know, again, not everyone is becoming a bomber. But that PTSD-like environment is something that we can chip away at. I mean, that is something that you can change. You can make things better for the average Tamil, the average Palestinian, or the average Chechen.
Is it possible to say something about within the groups as they consider whether they're going to do this, how they're going to do this, how the discussion goes about whether they will attack military targets or civilian targets?
And it was interesting. I included, again, there was a quote that I pulled out, and the failed bomber or deterred bomber was saying, you know, I could have blown up in the vegetable market, but I chose to cross the street and go to the area where there were soldiers. And, you know, I make the distinction. And so the bomber, and of course this is a bomber who was caught, and so, you know, it begs the question, well, had they blown up in the market, would they have been caught, or would they have been a successful bomber that didn't interview or that no one else could interview? Many of the people do make the distinction. Some of the people with whom you speak make less of a distinction, and there's a rationalization behind it. From their perspective, again, if you look at the Palestinian case, they look at Israelis, and every Israeli is either a current soldier, a past soldier, or a future soldier because of universal conscription. And the Israelis look at the Palestinian side and see, you know, an unadulterated group of terrorist supporters, little terrorist children, and they don't really make those distinctions as well. And I think as a result, that conflict in terms of hatred of the other is very, very high. Whereas when I did my interviews in Sri Lanka, the perception of the average Tamil or the perception of the average Sinhalese individual with whom I spoke, that they don't like the leadership, but they don't hate the other side to such an extent that they want to see gross civilian casualties. And that is reflected in the polling. You know, do you support the use of suicide bombing against civilians? In the Tamil areas, basically they're saying no. And the terrorist group knows this, and so that they have limited their targeting to political, military, and army targets. Whereas among Palestinians, you know, the average rank-and-file Palestinians are saying, well, yes, we do support it, and so there's no holds barred for the organizations. They're not going to lose any popularity by killing women and children if the sort of the mass of the people are supportive of this tactic against civilians.
Mm. Well, that gets this interesting question about the link between suicide terrorism and popular support within the people from whom the terrorists are, from where the terrorists are drawn, that it can go either way. That is, you can over time go from no support for it to support, or it can go the other way. And I guess particularly I'm interested in this this question of how it is, what happens that turns popular support against the use of suicide terrorism?
And that's a great question, because, you know, what's nice to know, what I found interesting, you know, as I was doing this research, is that the popular support is not a linear. It's not always going to be progressive, a little to a bit more, to a bit more, to a lot of support, that it can sort of spring back the other way, that there are certain things that if it's done, people will reject it. And I'll give you two examples. One is the popular support for suicide bombing in Jordan is been one of the only places in the Arab world. In July of 2005, the Pew Global Attitude Survey came out, and basically support for suicide bombing in the larger Muslim world is down in most places. In Jordan, actually, it had gone up. After this attack on November 9th at the weddings in Jordan against the four hotels, in which clearly there were no foreigners, there were no Americans in the room, this was a Jordanian wedding, and this is well known because one of the suicide bombers, a woman, did not detonate, and so we have her as a resource to discuss the planning and the operation. Support in Jordan has really declined significantly. I mean, they're outraged. And, you know, part of what I've been following along is some of the work that's been done in the field of psychology, where they identify tipping points, and they identify the point at which someone goes from being a passive supporter to a violent activist, but also at what point they're demobilized. They get so disgusted with what the organization has done that they decide, you know, for once and for all, they've had it. And the example that John Horgan at the University of St. Andrews gives is there's a gentleman named Sean O'Callaghan, and O'Callaghan was very conservative, from a small town, member of the IRA, and he happened to be sitting in Derry with a group of IRA members, and a news story came on the TV about a bomb that had gone off in London, killing a policewoman. And the head of the IRA unit, little unit there, said, oh, well, I hope she's pregnant, and then we kill two for one. And this particular statement was so disgusting to O'Callaghan that not only did he leave the group, but he became an informer for the police. And I think that in terms of counterterrorism, it's much better for us to show the organizations to be, you know, sort of bloodthirsty and hypocritical and get individuals who are already in the groups to get turned off and sort of flip them, to use the terminology, rather than trying to infiltrate the groups or trying to increase the levels of pressure or counterterrorism or intelligence, which we don't have. So this is a much better way. And again, having Muslim scholars come forward and say this is antithetical to Islam is a very important feature of this, because I think the majority, I think it's as much as 71% of the bombers interviewed believe that Islam permits bombing attacks, and 81% believe that Islam allows the actions of the suicide bomber and they will become a martyr in heaven. Whereas if the Islamic scholars come forward and say, martyrdom is not a temporal designation, we are overstepping our bounds, you know, as humans, by saying you're going to be a martyr, that's only for God to decide. And I think if we just plant the seed of doubt, that is, again, sufficient to start the ball rolling.
We are at our midpoint here. I have a caller we'll get to in just a moment. Again, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Mia Bloom, assistant professor of political science at University of Cincinnati. If you would like to read more on this subject, by the way, you can look for her recent book. It's entitled Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror, published by Columbia University Press. The book came out last May. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here locally in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Yeah. Don't these suicide bombers realize that by staying alive and maybe devoting, say, 3 hours a day to building up their infrastructure or homes or hospitals, they could contribute over 1,000 hours in a year and contribute a lot more to their society than a one-time cataclysmic event ruining a comparatively small number of lives? That's my question. Don't they realize they could do a lot more good by staying alive and working than they could by blowing up a few people?
Yeah.
It's very interesting because Al-Qaeda and the Jamia Islamiya that's in Southeast Asia, Hamas and Hezbollah, whether they're transnational or national, they're always sacrificing the best and the brightest of their community. And I think that your caller has identified the fact that, you know, this is their future that they're sacrificing. They're not taking the individual who has some sort of psychological pathology, someone who wants to die. In fact, many of the Islamic organizations are prohibited from using someone who wants to die and is depressed and wants to commit suicide. They actually have to send that person away. But they are looking at individuals who are the best and the brightest. First of all, because they have a certain amount of selection at their disposal. If you've got, according to Nasra Hassan, for every bomber lost, the group can recruit 12 more. If you've got, you know, 10 or 12 people in front of you, you can select on certain variables. And so among Saudi potential bombers that want to go to Iraq, the person with a university education in all likelihood speaks English. Well, this is very useful. The person with a university education among Palestinians likely speaks Hebrew. That will help them blend into a civilian crowd, will help them be able to, you know, bring their explosive device to its destination successfully. But in the process, you're really sacrificing the best and the brightest of your community. And I think the long-term ramifications, not just that you've lost this group of individuals, but that you've made this idea of martyrdom and sacrifice attractive to the children, to the whole new generation that don't want to grow up and be doctors and lawyers and engineers, but want to grow up to be suicide bombers. That's what also worries me.
There's another thing that sticks in my mind. It's not quite in a province of suicide bombers, but I recall the Taliban prohibited music. But I wonder what would happen to some of the Taliban members if they would hear loud music over big stadium-type PAs that was like a Christian rock music, only it was music in their genre that glorified their God. And it might even infect them as to, hey, this is a positive message about our God. This is not a negative message. I realize that's not in your province, but I wonder if you have any.
Well, I don't know. So, I mean, I think the problem, and we've talked about, you know, how do you appeal to the masses to provide some sort of bread and circuses so that they're less interested in using violence and maybe they're distracted. You know, do we create television shows that engage them? The problem is, if you are an Islamist, you eschew these, you know, art, this kind of art, music, theater, television, film. All of these things are impure. And so it would be difficult to convince an individual who's antithetical to music because it's considered to be maybe a sin to listen to music, even if it has a very positive message for Islam. But there are different ways to do it. And what's interesting is that, for those of your listeners that just saw that, well, it's not a very good movie, but the movie Munich, when Black September finally disbanded in 1974, you know, you had 100 of these very sort of true blue Black September activists that Yasser Arafat didn't know what to do with. And so what they did was they married them off, because this was a way of demobilizing the individuals from terrorism. You know, they gave them a nice sort of check when they got married. And, in fact, they created an incentive structure. If they had a child within the first year, there was another check. In other words, making them family men would more likely dissuade them from, you know, continuing their violence and their terrorism. The problem has been among the suicide bombers, among the many of the Islamist suicide bombers, many of them are married or have children, and this is not a deterrent. And so, you know, what works at one point in time may be less persuasive 20, 30 years later.
Hmm. Just for a second to return, I'm interested in your discussion of how it is that these organizations should choose the best and the brightest among their people to be the ones to sacrifice themselves. I think you have to spend a moment thinking about how useful that is for the group dynamic and the group psychology, because that allows the members of the group to point to that person and say, here, look at this. This is an exemplary person. This is the best person that we have. They have chosen to make this great sacrifice. What are the rest of you doing? And it would be, I'm sure that lends prestige to the cause and to the organization much more so than it would be if the person who was making the sacrifice was somehow a more marginal person in society.
Oh, and absolutely. I mean, aside from the fact that there are these tactical advantages to using someone who is more intelligent or more accomplished, speaks more than one language, or has some or even a whole university degree, What it also does is it creates in the minds of the audiences, not just among, let's say, the people in the conflict region, but for the outside world, you're looking at these people and you think, well, wait a second, this is an individual who has everything to live for. What, you know, it makes us question what is truly going on in this conflict that is making individuals who should be going out and, you know, joining the law firm instead of blowing up. What was also interesting is that many of the organizations, when they're selecting the women, select on the more attractive woman. They're looking for the woman that's going to be telegenic because they know that the picture of this individual is going to be broadcast over and over again. And so, you know, there are, again, some exceptions, but by and large, majority of the Palestinian female bombers are extremely attractive women. And so it's not that they were unattractive and unmarriageable or, you know, the dregs of the society. They're looking for attractive, telegenic people because part of the propaganda machine after they've perpetrated this act of suicide terrorism is to use it for, you know, use the videos, use the pictures, poster everywhere. And it's more appealing to have someone both who's accomplished, someone who's good-looking, and someone who exemplifies the best and the brightest of your society.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with some other people. We have someone on cell phone here on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I was curious. This form of protest of blowing yourself up and destroying others obviously has had some effect, but what about the method of nonviolent civil disobedience? Gandhi, why isn't the Palestinians and others adopted this method? Because it would cost the enemy a lot more to put them in prison for and the disruption, if there was enough of the passive resistance in this method, that would be much more effective than blowing themselves up.
It, you know, and it's a great question. It was a question that, you know, sort of many people affiliated with, let's say, the National Democratic Institute in Washington, D.C. asked. And so there was a project a few years ago where the head of Time Warner, the cable company, together with people at the National Democratic Institute, decided what they were going to try to find out. Why was there no Gandhi-like protest among Palestinians? And, of course, the first question Palestinians asked was, who's Gandhi? So they took the movie and they translated it into Palestinian dialect and with Ben Kingsley went around the territories showing the film. And the problem was, you know, first of all, I give kudos to Ben Kingsley for traveling around, but the problem was that on the one hand, Palestinians say it doesn't matter how we protest, you know, the Israelis shoot us, and you know, with rubber bullets, but you know, sometimes with live ammunition. And so part of the problem is that the Israelis are not the British, but also within their own community, anyone who's advocating nonviolence may also be accused of being a traitor. And so that there has been this process within the Palestinian community, whether it was early on historically during the first Arab revolt in 1936 to 39, during the first Intifada that was in the, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, and then even more recently, if you look at Gaza, there is a tendency to see a lot of Palestinian-on-Palestinian violence and accusations of being a collaborator or someone who's helping the Israelis. And so anyone advocating nonviolence in that context is actually putting their own lives at risk, not so much from the Israelis, but also from their own community. But I would say that you're absolutely right. If the Palestinians had engaged in hunger strikes instead of suicide bombing, I think that they would have a lot more than they have now as far as political bona fides to negotiate, as well as world public support and opinion.
Well, you were just talking about how impactful it was to show pictures of intelligent, attractive people that have killed themselves, who have lots of opportunities. It would seem to me that having the media coverage of people being corralled and beaten would be a lot more empathetic in the West and other people, other places, for the Palestinian cause to go this way rather than say this is a mindless act and go the other way of a violent means.
No, and you're absolutely right. The problem is the pictures of people being beaten and corralled and mistreated are precisely the kinds of things that are inspiring individuals to become suicide bombers rather than inspiring them to proceed with nonviolence. I mean, you know, we might see eventually a nonviolent movement, but part of the nonviolent movement requires a certain amount of constraint on the part of the other side. And so since both sides tend to be rather unconstrained, you do see a lot of the beatings. You see people being shot. You see people being hosed with water cannons, sometimes both Israeli as well as Palestinians, if they're peace negotiators or peace demonstrators. There was an instance where a young girl, an American girl from Oregon, Rachel Corey, they rolled over with a tank. I mean, she's an American girl. The problem is that nonviolence in this particular highly sparked violent environment doesn't resonate as much as violence, and people are inspired by the same things that would have inspired Gandhi. These things feed into a psyche that wants to perpetrate more violence and exact more revenge.
I think, too, that there's something that you have to consider, and you also go into it in the book, is that if you have within an overall movement a number of smaller groups or factions that are vying for power, that the use of violence and perhaps the use of suicide terror can be an escalating thing. If one group does it, then another group is going to feel that they have to do it or to somehow outdo, and I think outbidding is the term that you use in the book, groups may end up escalating the violence to show that they are more serious than another group or more effective than another group or more committed than another group, something like that.
Absolutely. And what was so interesting to me is depending on if the money is coming from outside the conflict zone and, you know, sort of imagine it as a having a MacArthur Foundation application process, that, you know, all these groups want this outside money that's coming from Saudi Arabia or from Al-Qaeda or previously from Saddam Hussein, and so that there's a huge incentive to do something bigger, something more spectacular, something that's going to get you on the cover of the New York Times or the Washington Post or the lead story in Al Jazeera and Al Manar. And, you know, again, journalistic integrity, you know, holding that as a constant, if it bleeds, it leads. I mean, the more bloody something is, the more press it gets. And thus, the organizations have an incentive to not just outdo one another, but outdo one another in a very violent and bloody way because they're all chasing that kitty of money.
Well, let's take another caller. Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, is there still a financial incentive that accrues to the families of suicide bombers? I remember, for example, Saddam Hussein used to, I think he would guarantee like $25,000 or some such figure to the families of suicide bombers. And I'm wondering, is that still a factor or is it more idealistic than that?
You know, it's interesting. It varies from conflict to conflict. For instance, the bombers that are leaving Saudi Arabia to go to Iraq are tending to come from fairly wealthy families and are self-funded. And so, you know, their families are not getting a big check. And in fact, on some of the jihadi websites, most that the organizations will do is publish the name and the phone number of the family so that, you know, you can call them and congratulate them. Among the Palestinians, the idea of the compensation actually arose because the British, under colonialism, had instituted certain principles that if you were involved in violence, your house was destroyed. And this would be a deterrent from getting involved because even if you were killed in the process, you knew that your family would suffer the consequences. And this was then adopted by the Israelis, who then continued the policy. And so that check originally was to rebuild the family home that was going to be destroyed. The Israelis just last year finally did away with this policy of bulldozing and destroying the homes of the families, is because they realized, first of all, it wasn't a deterrent, and if anything, they were starting to see the brothers and sisters of bombers who had been displaced now joining the groups. And so sometimes you have members from within the same family, like the Muqdisi family would just be joining in large groups. I would say that the Palestinian Authority for a long time would compensate individuals so that even if the money wasn't coming from Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden or from Saudi Arabia, but there is, unfortunately, a great deal of money still floating around. And families, if they're not compensated directly, so many hundreds or even thousands will attend the funeral that a donation will be made, and so that there will be some sort of compensation. But it would be absolutely wrong to think that there's a financial incentive in all this. The finances is just a way of assuaging maybe some guilt that the child may have about leaving the family in a bad position.
What kind of numbers do you see?
I mean, more recent, because of this now, because of the change in government from going from a Palestinian Authority to Hamas, I honestly don't know. I think that the compensation might be reintroduced. But I think it was just very small, maybe like 5,000. What's interesting is a recent study by Scott Atran in the Territories said that there's an inverse relationship between the amount of money that they're offered and there's the incentive. In other words, the Palestinian judgments of acceptability of compensation between 1,000 dinars, 10,000 dinars, or 1,000,000 dinars, actually for the 1,000,000 dinars, was less acceptable than the 1,000 dinars. And so, in other words, just the basic amount of money to pay for the funeral and compensate the family if they get kicked out of the home, not to be making money. But it's somewhere along that line between 1,000 dinars and 1,000,000 dinars.
I want to thank the caller. We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Mia Bloom. She is assistant professor of political science at the University of Cincinnati. She is the author of the book Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror, published last May by the Columbia University Press. We have some other callers. We'll go next to someone in Chicago. This is line 3. Hello.
This is Jan Payne, but anyway.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. I got two real quick questions. First of all, the bomber that got caught, if there's any way that he ever got out, would he still, I guess, be eligible to do it again, or would he want to do it again? And then the other question is, what's going to keep some family member from saying, well, my family's low on the totem pole here, and he goes out and does it on his own, it's not even being represented by an organization? And I guess the third question would be, does the organization pick these people to do this?
Those are good questions. I think particularly the one to the extent that you and other people have managed to talk with people who were intended to be suicide bombers but did not succeed. Is there any way of getting at this question of, if you had it to do over again, would you?
It's hard to know, because on the one hand, there's an incentive to say, oh, absolutely, I would never do it again, I feel regret, because they're hoping that, they're hoping for some sort of leniency. And then there's the exact opposite incentive to say, no, absolutely, I'm depressed by the fact that I failed, and I would absolutely do it again, because they may be worried their failure reflects badly on their family and on their community. And, by and large, it's what we do see is, if you talk to someone, sort of the first time you talk to them, you get a lot of the rhetoric, you get a lot of well, this is what was done to me, and this is what inspired me, and get a lot of the nationalist verbatim rhetoric, one person to the next, a lot of what they've been spoon-fed. If you talk a little bit more, you can start getting at what are some of the personal incentives, how they went about it. And I'd say that most tend to be somewhat saddened by the fact that they failed, but they still feel that they've made a positive contribution to their community by the effort. One or two individuals have expressed their regret, but again, it was in hopes of getting the authorities to go easy on them. And when the authorities didn't, they turned around, and there was one woman in particular, a Chechen woman, who, after she was sentenced, regardless of the fact that she changed her mind, but in the process of taking apart the bomb, a police officer was killed as he tried to disable the improvised explosive device. And so she was still sentenced as if she had committed the act and hadn't changed her mind. And sort of on the heels of the sentence, she turns around and goes, I wish I could kill all of you right now. So it's really, there's no way to know. I think it depends when you ask. What's more interesting for me is also the families. When the action is first perpetrated, the family members are very supportive, and you'll have statements in the press from the mother saying, I wish I had more than one child to give to the cause. If you go back 6 months later, it's a very different story. Mm. And again, people are very, they miss their family, they miss their son, they miss their mother, they start to really have doubts as to whether this was a good idea.
I think one of the things that, when you look at this cluster of things that go to individual motivation. There are some people apparently who are motivated in part, among other things, but in part by the desire to do something important, to be remembered for that. And that might go to this question of would there be someone who, as part of their motivation to increase the status of their family by doing that?
I mean, and absolutely. And here's the problem, though. If the if the person, the recruiter, I mean, I say recruiter in a very vague way because people are volunteering, but if the recruiter gets a sense that the person wants fame and, you know, fame and fortune, then they are supposed to reject them. They'll say that this is not, motivation. But absolutely that's the case, because the societies have made virtual rock stars out of these martyrs. And so, I mean, if you want to extrapolate it to the United States, you have people eating worms to get 15 seconds of fame, you know, on Fear Factor in this country. You can imagine what, you know, the lure would be for a Palestinian sort of who's not really accomplished, who's not really doing anything with their lives, to really make a big splash and be remembered, especially since streets and parks and squares are named after them, and all the martyrs are well known to the children. And instead of having posters of Janet Jackson or Avril Lavigne up on their walls, they have posters of the suicide bombers.
Let's talk with someone else. Champaign County, this is line one. Hello.
Hi. You kind of did point out that the reimbursement was started out with this British colonialism, but the reimbursement actually reflected a system that reimbursed people that were killed in any circumstance. So it wasn't simply people were, you know, only getting paid to blow themselves up. There was a system of it's partially the Islamic system of compensation for loss, where if somebody was killed by an Israeli, if somebody was killed by a shell going off, that also was compensatable.
Well, that's absolutely true. What's interesting, though, is at some point in time, there was a bit of a shift in terms of not just a regular compensation, whether someone was a shaheed, a martyr, someone killed by the Israelis, or an istishhad, someone who self-martyred, but there started to be a financial incentive attached to the kill ratio. In other words, let's say, for instance, it was a staggered rate that if you killed more than a certain number, there was a bonus. And so there was an ideal of attempting to kill 20. If you get up to 20, you know, you get an extra compensation. So there was differentiation eventually made around 2002 and 2003. And again, in this recent survey that was conducted of hundreds of people who are either failed bombers or bombers who sort of would-be bombers, as well as the larger communities, when they asked them, you know, would God approve of the shaheed who kills 10, the shaheed who kills 1, or there's no difference? And the answer was there's no difference. But who would God approve of more, the shaheed who kills 1 or the shaheed who kills 10, and or no difference? And people answered, well, of course God approves of the shaheed who kills 10.
Well, again, this built up over a period of time.
Yes.
I think over another point that was made about the nonviolence and how that would have been a better thing, that contrary to the idea that would have been seen by us in the West, you know, there was a lot of nonviolent resistance. There still is to this day a lot of nonviolent resistance that isn't recognized. And,
the First Intifada is a case in point of what you're talking about. It was years of, you know, stone throwing or demonstrations or marches that seem to have fallen on deaf ears. And then it's only in the Second Intifada that we're seeing this violence. So you're absolutely right.
We're coming down to the point where we're almost out of time, and I have to apologize. I have a caller I think we can't get to. Just, I'm interested as a way of finishing up here to talk for a minute or so about some sort of bottom line things that you can say about, is there anything that you could do to try to prevent or to turn around at least this kind of techniques, this extreme violence in the form of suicide terror?
Well, it sort of segues to what the last caller was asking. I think that he makes a very good point, because it's going to be absolutely impossible for us to deter the individual who's already made the decision and, you know, has the improvised explosive device strapped to themselves. what we can do, the impact we can have, is addressing the community. Is that community going to look at that person with pride or with shame? Is that community going to feel that they can get more through a peaceful negotiation, through a peace process, or through the use of violence? Are we giving them anything to live for, or are we giving them absolutely no reason? So part of it is somewhat in our control. You know, we've been asked sometimes, well, barring U.S. foreign policy, what can be done? And my response is, why are we barring U.S. foreign policy when U.S. foreign policy in Iraq is a contributing factor? And it's a contributing factor, and sort of the policies of assimilation or discrimination in Europe is a contributing factor. I mean, there are things that we can control. But, you know, I think the recent events in Europe with the cartoons is an example of the fact that Muslims around the world feel that they are being humiliated and attacked at every level. And the anger and the angst and the aggravation are expressing themselves through violence because they feel that they're only heard when they use violence. They're not heard sort of in other contexts. And although this might be a controversial thing for me to say on your radio show, I would say that, you know, if we advocate spreading democracy through the Arab world, and then organizations or parties that we don't like are elected, if we then refuse to deal with those organizations and parties, we are showing, you know, sort of the larger constituency, the people who voted, that this is a sham election, that we don't actually believe in these ideals. And so it may mean occasionally sitting down with individuals we don't like and then making them partner to the process, giving them something to lose. If, for instance, Hamas, now that it has been elected, has nothing to lose, there's no way they'll give up violence. But if they think that they can get a piece of the pie, well, then they're absolutely self-interested. They want power as much as any other political party wants power. And so including them in a process may actually increase the likelihood that they will moderate their demands over time, as was the case with Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Well, there we will have to finish. Again, for people who want to read more on the subject, you can look at the book we've mentioned. It's titled Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror. It was published last May by the Columbia University Press by our guest Mia Bloom. She is assistant professor of political science at the University of Cincinnati. Professor Bloom, thank you very much.
David, thank you so much for having me, and I want to thank your listeners for their time.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. We first broadcast this show February 17th of 2006. The book we talked about, Dying to Kill, is still available and will be coming out in paperback in June from the Columbia University Press. Support for our show, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information available on the web at infantparent.com. That's it for Focus for this morning, but we want you to stay tuned. There is much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be a physicist and science writer, Philip Shuey. We'll talk with him about his book, The Grid, A Journey Through the Heart of Our Electrified World. That begins at 1:06 Central Time this afternoon. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. May wheat trading at $4.88.5, up 1.75. In Chicago, May wheat $4.67.5, up 2. July $4.80.75, up 1.5. September $4.92, up 2.5. May corn $4.08.5, down 1.25. July $4.20, down 1.25. December corn $4.09.25, down 1/4. May soybeans $7.68.75, up 2.25. July $7.85, up 2.5. And November beans $8.12, up 1.25. May soybean meal $2.23.20, up 90.